We're Golden Hours Radio, Oregon's accessible radio service in Portland.
You're listening to Golden Hours Portland, a contributor-supported service of Oregon Public Broadcasting.
It's now time for Keeping Current, and here's your host, Wayne Potter.
Well, welcome. This is Wayne Potter, and this is the place and the time where we talk about the ideas and the issues that shape your everyday life. Tonight, we're going to try a little something different. I recently was at Kaneda Lodge over in the Warm Springs Indian Reservation, and I had a great opportunity while I was there to meet a gentleman by the name of Wes Hare. He happens to be the city manager of the city of LeGrand, Oregon. And he has done some very interesting traveling throughout his experiences, and particularly within the last 6 months, he spent some time in the country of Iraq, where he provided some management assistance to various leaders in that area. And so I asked him to share his experience tonight, to talk a little bit about what it was like to go there and what it was like to come back and what are some of the kind of things that he did. And that's going to take up the first half of our program tonight, and we're going to follow that up by a discussion and talk about the importance of and the role of trying to handle conflict through conflict resolution methods. And my guest tonight from Portland State University is one of the core faculty members there by the name of Tom Hastings, who teaches lots of classes and puts on a variety of different conferences and so on at the university. And we're going to talk a little bit about his knowledge and experience of what's happening in the world and how conflict resolution techniques, systems, and methods are useful in terms of resolving some major problems that have actually involved violence. So, Jerry, if you would do me the honors, if you would start off our show tonight by the interview with Wes Hare.
I'm sitting in a lounge in a lodge located in Kaneda, that's in Oregon on the Warm Spring Indians Reservation. And I'm sitting here with a gentleman by the name of Wes Hare, who's come to make a presentation at a conference. And we just happened to run into one another, and he has some rather interesting stories to tell about his international adventures. And so I'd like to acquaint you a little bit with Wes Hare and where he hails from and what kind of things he does besides travel internationally. So let's start off, Wes, by having you tell this my audience a little bit about where do you come from in Oregon?
Well, I haven't come very far, really. I'm from Bend, originally graduated from Bend High School, so I'm only about 50 miles from home. But more recently, I'm the city manager in LeGrand, where I've been for the last 9 years. And before that, I was a city manager in the small community of Oak Ridge, over on the west side of the mountains. And most of my life has been spent in Oregon, although as a young person, my father was a military officer, so I spent time in Europe and in different parts of the world and sort of acquired a taste for travel and different cultures.
So then your interest began way back when, in a sense. Were you as interested in traveling internationally when you were young, or was that just sort of a part of the territory that you included in your life when you were with your parents?
I think I always enjoyed it. I've always considered myself very, very lucky to have had the background that I did, to have had the parents that I had, and who were, when we lived in Europe, were really intent on making sure that their children got to see some of the great cities of the world, Rome, London, Amsterdam, and so we, I think I've had a lifelong taste for travel and just, like I said, seeing other people, meeting other people. I really enjoy that.
Now, going internationally with your parents and making choices on your own, deciding to to break up your life, if you will, and spend some time in the United States and going elsewhere, has to take some very personal choices. So what were those choices or those events which led to the choices of going internationally and being a part of another country's government?
Well, of course, I've tried to sort of structure my life so that when my children were growing up, I was around, and I think that probably influenced my decision to become a city manager, which typically one doesn't think of that occupation as one that involves a lot of travel. But I also looked, even as a city manager, for opportunities to travel and to be a part of things. When I was in Oak Ridge, for example, I connected with the University of Oregon and was part of a program that brought local officials from Japan who actually came to Oak Ridge to study how we did local government and local economic development. And then that led to me going to rural Japan to speak at a conference and exchange some ideas with people over there. And then since coming to La Grande, I've been to Indonesia a couple of times to work with local government associations in that country. And then, of course, most recently, I spent 7 months in Iraq on a project, a U.S. Agency for International Development project called the Local Government Project, where we were trying to plant seeds of local government, if you will, in my case, in Karbala, Iraq.
So this is your decision, but obviously you have a wife and you have children. Did it take some kind of persuasion to let your wife go on trips like this, or just what?
Well, for the most part, my wife and I have tried to travel together, and we have a lot. In fact, we're leaving for Croatia in a couple of weeks for 10 days on a USAID mission, and that's been wonderful. I mean, for both of us, we've learned together. My wife is extremely insightful, probably is a better international development specialist than I am, so we help each other in that respect. As far as the Iraq project, that was the really difficult one because I was gone for a long period of time. My children are all grown and out of the house now, so that was one factor that made it easier to do. I think, you know, my wife and I were married young. We've been together for 32 years and talked about it at great length about the pros and the cons of doing it. I think my wife realized it was something that was a unique opportunity for me and was willing to part with my company for that period of time. I've never questioned her at great length about why she felt that way, but she seemed happy to see me when I got back, so I guess that's the good news. But it was a sacrifice. It's not something I would ever do again, but as sort of a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, it was, I think, worth it in the end.
Now, deciding to go over to Iraq was one thing, and then getting over there and experiencing it was yet another kind of side of that experience. How was your perception before you went, and your perception of actually while you were there, how has that changed?
Well, it's certainly the way that it's changed more than any other, because I don't know that I can't even really tell you what my perceptions were before I left. I mean, I'd certainly been reading in the newspaper and following events, but I didn't have any concrete visions of what life might be like there. And so what I have now is a very personal understanding of the people, and of the people that I knew specifically. And I was fortunate. I was in a position where I actually lived with Iraqi people and, you know, interacted with them on a daily basis. I was handicapped in that I didn't speak the language, but I had, interpreters with me most of the time, and even when you couldn't speak the language, you could figure out a way to communicate with people if you needed to, and so I felt very privileged. I think the one perception that I would want to communicate to the American people is that the vast majority of the people of Iraq are good people, and no different in many respects than people anywhere else in the world. They want to live quietly, prosperous lives. They want to enjoy their family. They want to practice their faith. They want the same kinds of things that we want. And they have been the victims, I think, of traditions. I think they've been the victims of people, of selfish people. Sometimes they've been the victims of political strategies. Iraq, the nation of Iraq, was born out of the colonial era, and that has not been a happy beginning for many nations in the developing world, as I think we all know. But again, I think the biggest perception, the biggest change for me was just getting to know and understand the people that I met there.
Now, your entry into Iraq was a rather interesting kind of activity. Could you briefly describe? You wrote of this in your article that was in the Public Management magazine back in August of this year. For my audience, perhaps you could re-describe this entry into the great wilds of Iraq.
Well, yeah, and that's truly one where I had no idea what to expect. And I was just told, I arrived in Kuwait, and I was told that the next day there will be a convoy leaving for Hilla, which was near where I was to be working in Karbala. And it's about a 5-hour, 6-hour drive, I was told. And drove the freeway from Kuwait City to the border with Iraq. And of course, it's a very beautiful freeway. You know, drove it at normal speeds, you're kind of relaxed, you're looking at this desert countryside, very prosperous nation of Kuwait. Then you arrive at the border and the chaos begins. I mean, there's cars and all sizes and descriptions, there's military vehicles, there's tanks, there's you name it, it's all there, and you have to go through a sort of Byzantine process to get through the border. There's no logic to it. It just, you know, you're just sort of do this, and you do it. Then you suddenly find yourself on a freeway that's now starting to look a little more decrepit than what you've seen in Kuwait. There's signs of warfare. There are derelict vehicles, you know, blown up tanks, that sort of thing, in various locations. And of course, you're traveling at about 100 plus miles an hour. And this is for security reasons, the theory being that a slow target is an easy target. And so, and the cars, this our convoy, were actually two U.S. SUVs traveling in tandem, jockeying back and forth, changing positions frequently at very high speeds. And as I said in my article, I must have offended someone because they put me in the vehicle with the gas cans. Filled with these big, obviously there are no gas stations in Iraq, and at least in that part of Iraq, so you had to carry your own gas with you. And so the driver and I, the Iraqi driver who spoke no English, were in this vehicle, and the gas is sloshing around and creating an interesting blend of fumes. And we're going at very high speeds, and at one point there are large piles of gravel alongside the road, and I'm not sure why they're even there. And as he was jockeying for position, the driver hit one of these piles of gravel, and the car actually went airborne, kind of at an angle. And I assumed that, you know, that death was pretty imminent, given the gas, and the car was no longer under control. Fortunately, the driver did a good job. If he'd hit the brakes, I wouldn't be doing the interview right now. He didn't. He managed to get the car back under control, and we survived. And he learned a new vocabulary word. And I was very grateful. And then, not long after that, we were confronted with a roadblock, a military roadblock, two U.S. Humvees, armored Humvees, with their machine guns pointed at us, and two soldiers coming at us with M16s leveled at our windshield, telling us that, you know, eventually after they determined we were not hostiles, that there had been a report of two SUVs that had been stolen, and they thought we were it. Fortunately, we weren't. So that was my introduction to Iraq, and of course, it's indescribable, the chaos. I mean, the roads, after we got off this 4-lane road, we get onto a 2-lane road that is packed with people. There are dead donkeys and dead camels and derelict vehicles and people and vehicles of every description. I've described Iraq as the land where all 1970s vintage Toyota Land Cruisers have gone to die, because they're there and they're in all conditions. And It was sort of a chaotic beginning to my 7 months there, but fortunately it was we survived it and found my way to Hilla and actually started to get into the work at that point.
So you were there about how long, and basically what were you to do while you were there?
I was there from the 14th of September 2003 until the 26th of March 2004. And my responsibility, I actually worked for my professional association, the International City County Management Association. And I was on a leave of absence from my job as a city manager in LeGrand. Our project was, ICMA, I should point out, was subcontracted to an organization called RTI International out of North Carolina, and their work, they're a nonprofit that does international development, nation building kind of work. Our job was to try and sort of create at least the seeds of local government in a country that had no experience, or at least no recent experience, with local government. They're, of course, under a dictatorship or in police states. The government is controlled at the center, and it's usually controlled through bureaucracies that do not give much autonomy to their local offices. They might have a branch office away from the capital, but all decisions are made at the center. And so our job was to try and sort of promote a more autonomous local government.
So basically what was there in the form of a government at this particular time, was it the occupational forces that were the organization, or was there any sense of local control at that point?
There was no local control, but there was government. What the United States did after the invasion was to try and take advantage of the existing structure. And most of that structure involved the central ministries in Baghdad. You would have like a Ministry of Public Works that would be responsible for water and sewer and that sort of thing. There was the Ministry of Electricity, responsible for electricity, the Ministry of Finance. And then they would have offices in the local, or in the cities in the country. And I was sent to Karbala. So there would be representatives from those federal agencies, if you will, but no real local control, autonomy, access to resources. When you would talk with the local branch of the government and you would say, we need to do this, then the response would be, well, we need to get approval from Baghdad and money from Baghdad in order to make it happen.
Now, so your presentations were made to what sort of audiences?
Well, presentations were a part of what we were doing, and typically the audiences that I would speak to would be, well, they would range from government agency employees, and we would talk to them about everything from democracy, basic principles of democracy, to how to create a job description. We found early on that there were no such thing in their agencies, and the reason that they would tell us is that we didn't need job descriptions under Saddam because if you were a member of the Ba'ath Party, then that's how you got your job, and your job was basically to do whatever the Ba'ath Party wanted you to do. So things like job descriptions were not relevant. So we would talk to audiences about those kinds of things. We would also go, and I'm happy to report, we would listen to people in villages and in neighborhoods about the kinds of problems they were experiencing, and then try and come up with projects that would address some of their biggest concerns, which at that time tended to be infrastructure concerns, electricity, water, sewage, drainage, roads, the kinds of things that most of us are concerned about. And as a city manager, I was well trained because I hear complaints about those kinds of things pretty regularly and have for a number of years.
Now, you had other co-workers alongside of you doing similar or different things perhaps. So what was the nature of their work and who were they?
We had in each of the communities where we were working, we had teams. We had local LGTs. They were called local government teams. And our local government teams would include usually someone who had had experience in what were called civil society organizations, what we would normally refer to as nonprofits or NGOs, and they would try and foster the development of NGOs that were promoting democratic values, empowering women. There were a whole range of activities there. My job was a local government specialist. We had a rule of law specialist, and a finance person. We had a finance specialist, and that was pretty much our team. And sometimes the personalities would change, but those were sort of the job descriptions.
Now, while you were in Karbala, you were living in a residence with other people from Iraq, or was there something like a green zone in Karbala similar to Baghdad?
No, there was no green zone, and something I'm very grateful for. Particularly the first 4 months or so that I was there, security was always a concern, but we lived pretty normally. We were able to move about pretty freely. We usually had some people accompanying us. After December, we actually got two what they call PSDs, personal security detachment. These were two basically professional bodyguards, I guess would be the best way to describe them, one from England and one from Australia. But prior to that time, we were kind of on our own, and I'm very grateful for that. We were able to mingle, and I lived in a hotel in downtown Karbala and mingled freely with people from the community. We eventually moved into a house, and yes, we had Iraqis living with us, and we had daily interaction with Iraqis, and that was true throughout the time that I was there. It is one of the just tragic realities that it has become an increasingly unsafe place, and so you have to sort of look out for personal security a lot of the time.
Is there any way to measure success in a project like this? I mean, this was a pretty topsy-turvy world, a lot of new things really sort of floating in amongst the public and so on. So, I mean, how do you evaluate? How do you determine the value of the kind of things that went on there?
Well, there were formal attempts to evaluate. There was actually an M&D team, I think, and I couldn't even tell you what the M&D stands for, measurement and something, M&E maybe, measurement and evaluation, that would tour the country and would visit the different offices and determine how things were going. And there's kind of a funny story. I was the acting team leader when one of the teams showed up, and they went through this very exhaustive interview with me about our work and what we'd accomplished and what projects we were involved with. And one of their questions was, how secure are things here? Are you feeling pretty secure? And this was in October, I believe, so I'd only been there maybe a month and a half. And I said, oh, gosh, it's great. We're just very secure. We feel very welcome here. Life is good. And we were sitting in our home, and they were having some tea or something, and I got a phone call that said, you need to evacuate immediately. And of course, this would happen. I came to learn that this was not something that was all that extraordinary, but you need to get into, and when you got an evacuation order, that means you grabbed your hat and hopped into the car, and off you went to wherever it was you were supposed to be evacuated to. And in our case, this was the community of Hilla, which was our regional headquarters about 35 miles away, and we had more of a compound there. And so I came back and said to the M&E team, well, we have to evacuate right now, so I take back everything I said about how secure we are. As it turned out, there was an interesting story surrounding that. The reason for that evacuation was that the United States was planning to arrest a fellow who's been in the news a lot lately, Murtada Sadr, and as it turned out, they chose not to arrest him during that period of time, and so the evacuation was canceled, and we were sent home after a day or so. But at any time there was violence, or they believed that we would be under some extraordinary threat, we would be moved out, and that happened probably three or four times while I was there.
Now, apparently the building that you were in Karbala eventually was subject to a bombing. How were you there? What happened, etc.?
Yeah, on December 27th, I was actually getting ready to leave that very day to go to Hilla to catch a convoy to Kuwait to go to meet my wife in London for a vacation. We took about a six-day vacation. And ordinarily, we just stayed at our office and worked through the day. But on that day, because I wanted to leave, we'd gone home for lunch. All the international staff had gone from our office to our home to have lunch, and then I was going to leave that afternoon. While we were having lunch, we heard a series of explosions, and it turned out that there were three huge suicide bombings, one attacking the government center where our office was located, one attacking a Bulgarian military compound where we work there every day, doing work with a military civil affairs unit, and then also at the logistics compound, which was located outside of town. Many deaths at our office. The building was rendered unusable. It wasn't completely destroyed, but badly damaged. We got an immediate radio contact from our coworkers who were still at the office, saying all the windows and doors have been blown out. Fortunately, nobody here seriously hurt. We had one Iraqi colleague who had a slight cut from flying glass, but basically everybody was okay. And we then came to learn the extent of the tragedy, and it truly was. There were, I think, ultimately 50 or 60 people killed by these three bombs. And of course, things were very unsettled. I was allowed to leave. I was in a private vehicle, which was kind of an unusual way for us to travel, in a little local type car. And that was my first sense of Iraq. Well, not